Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last month, Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders' economic plan received national attention after economist Gerald Friedman published a 53-page analysis. Professor Friedman wrote that Senator Sanders' ambitious program of social reform, including workers' rights protections, progressive tax reforms, and universal health insurance, would not only dramatically increase employment and national income, but would also reduce poverty and narrow the gap between the rich and the poor. Soon after Professor Friedman's analysis was released, four former chairs of the President's Council of Economic Advisers, that's President Obama, signed an open letter to Bernie Sanders and the professor, saying his claims are not supported by economic evidence. We invited those four economists to join us today, but they were not available. So on today's Your Call, we are spending the hour talking about Bernie Sanders' economic policy. How would it affect income, jobs, economic growth, and taxes? Today, we are joined by Gerald Friedman, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst and author of the report, What Would Sanders Do? Estimating the Economic Impact of Sanders' Program. Professor Friedman supports both Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. Hi, Professor Friedman. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you. So your report got a lot of attention, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes. But first off, why did you decide to look at Senator Sanders' economic plan and write such an extensive analysis of it?
Because I was hopelessly naive and also just curious. It went back to the summer before, summer of 2015. I spent a lot of time on the phone with a reporter from the Wall Street Journal who was doing an article about how much Bernie Sanders would increase government spending and taxes. And I kept trying to explain to her that increasing taxes doesn't necessarily increase what people will be spending, especially since so much of the tax plan would go to finance universal health insurance, which would replace private health insurance premiums and most out-of-pocket spending. So she published the article, the Wall Street Journal published the article, you know, Bernie Sanders will cost the American public $18 trillion or something. And I read that, and I said to a friend that, hey, you know, apart from everything that I had been saying about this, there's also a lot of other things that they're not taking account of, like some of these government programs would replace existing government programs, and some of these government programs would generate increased economic activity, which would lead to more employment, higher income, and higher tax revenues. So I said this, and you know, my friend said, well, why don't you write that? And I said, oh, that shouldn't be so hard. I just need to figure out a few elasticities and a few multipliers, it'll be done. So it's 6 months later, and hundreds and hundreds of hours of work later, I've produced this report, which was really just a draft. To do the whole thing, it's going to take several hundred hours of more work. Had I known how much work it would be and how much controversy I'd get myself into, then, oh, well, I probably would have done it anyway because it was really interesting. I've learned a lot.
Yeah.
I've learned a lot about his program, about how, you know, the American political system's working or not working. And I think we've had an effective dialogue that economists really understand these issues better and some people in the public, you know, who've been following, you know, maybe have learned something. I certainly have learned a lot, so that's a good thing.
Well, we're glad you did this because sometimes it's hard to figure out what the exact plan is. And it's even harder to figure out what would happen if it were to be implemented. And as you said, I mean, we live in a soundbite world, so Bernie Sanders is trying to tell people, well, your taxes might go up, but you won't have health care premiums every month, for example. So if you spend $1,000 on a health care premium, that will go away. And when you look at the amount of taxes you pay, that will even be lower. And so it's sometimes it's really hard to parse this out. So let's talk about the specifics. I mean, you know, even at the top, I said his plan is to pour $14.5 trillion into the economy, increase Social Security benefits, make college free, raise the minimum wage, close corporate tax loopholes, expand health care coverage. What would you add to that? What is important? What do we need to know about the plan that's important?
The plan involves a dramatic redistribution of income. First off, the plan is not a complete transformation of American political economy into something new. Basically, what he's proposing is to go back to the economic policies of the 1960s and the early 1970s in terms of the tax rates, in terms of things like free public higher education, in terms of single-payer health plan. We'll have a national single-payer health plan, but in the 1960s, most states had a de facto private single-payer plan through Blue Cross Blue Shield. So this is not a revolutionary change. I mean, Bernie Sanders calls himself a democratic socialist, and I'm sure he feels that he's a democratic socialist, but his program is not socialism at all. It's New Deal liberalism. It's going back to the Roosevelt, Kennedy, Johnson-type economic policy. Now, what you leave out in what you said is that there is a major reversal of economic policy and a dramatic narrowing of income differentials, achieved largely through very progressive taxes and the increase in the minimum wage. So between those two, you're raising the floor, and you're taking a lot from the rich. So we'll be returning to the inequality rates of the mid-1970s, before the tax cuts that began with Jimmy Carter and then Ronald Reagan. To me, that's a very good thing. Otherwise, there's huge increase in infrastructure spending, especially around climate mitigation and reduction in carbon usage. The one other piece that you left out related to this, in addition to the infrastructure spending for solar, is the carbon tax that he's proposing, most of which would be returned to the public, but it would raise the price of carbon and discourage use of carbon and help the environment. This is something that actually has a lot of support among Republicans, especially among Republican economists, but also Hank Paulson, Treasury Secretary under President Bush, W. Bush, favors a carbon tax. So carbon tax, infrastructure, public higher education, and, of course, single-payer health plan, financed largely through progressive taxes and the $15 minimum wage. That's the bulk of the program.
That is Gerald Friedman. He's professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. He analyzed Bernie Sanders' economic plan. It's called What Would Sanders Do? Estimating the Economic Impact of Sanders' Programs. And now I would like to welcome Mike Konzel to the show. Mike is a contributor to The Nation and a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. He focuses on inequality and a progressive vision of the economy. One of Mike's latest pieces for The Nation is called Bernie's Wall Street Plan is Actually Not Enough. Hi, Mike. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
So what are your thoughts about Jerry's analysis that Bernie Sanders' economic plan is really not that revolutionary? And yet what we're hearing from people like Hillary Clinton and others on the Democratic side is that there's no possible way you can get any of these things passed. It's pie in the sky. I mean, how would you describe Bernie Sanders' economic plan?
Well, to start, I just want to say that the Friedman paper has been a great addition to the conversation because it's gotten people talking about the macro economy again. How productive could we be? How rich could we be? How many people could be working? I think there's been a bit of a transition to kind of a little bit more micro scale of, minimum wage or sick time and family leave, which are incredibly important to everyday people's lives. But the macro economy really, really does set the tone for everything else. And by saying that there is still a lot of room to grow, I think that's a really productive contribution. There's been a lot of debate, over states quite a bit, particularly the permanent effects of multipliers, the idea that the stimulus is not just like good in the short and medium term, but that it would have like a really overtly dramatic effect, and how quickly and rapidly we could grow. Could we be 30% above where we would, where we might be otherwise in 10 years as opposed to 10 or 20% above? I think a lot of people think Jerry overstates that. We can, I don't know if it's worth getting the minutiae of that, but either way, I think it's important to be talking about the fact that there is room for infrastructure and other kinds of and particularly as the Federal Reserve is debating how low unemployment can go. You know, if unemployment could go a lot lower because people will come into the labor force and because there's still a lot of room to innovate and be more productive, I think that's a really important thing. So I suppose that's the pro and con of Jerry's paper. And it's really focused at people on Bernie's healthcare plan and other parts of his plan. It's interesting to see how he lines up with Hillary Clinton and with kind of a more Democratic establishment. I think what's really interesting about Bernie's plan, and I think it's very different than what we've seen from President Obama and from what we've seen so far with Hillary Clinton, is that he says, Senator Sanders says, we should raise taxes on everyone so that we can pay for more goods that everyone benefits from. Going back to 2008, President Obama is basically focused on not, he famously would not repeal the Bush tax cuts for middle-class people, or in essence, bring middle-class taxes back to where they were in the late 90s, but instead just focus on top earners, people who make more than $200,000 or $400,000 a year. We can do a lot of good by taxing those people more, and Hillary Clinton wants to tax people who make over $5 million a year more to pay for things like paid family leave. There's a lot of good things that can be done there, but really big transformation society, including making healthcare public as a single payer, can't be done on the rich alone. And so by pushing that argument forward, I think he's really opened up a space that would not have been opened up otherwise.
And that is Mike Konzel. He's a contributor for The Nation magazine and a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. He's got a piece in The Nation, and it's called Bernie's Wall Street Plan is Actually Not Enough. We'll talk about that later in the show with Mike. We are also joined by Gerald Friedman, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. He extensively analyzed Bernie Sanders' economic plan, and he found that median household income would grow by $22,000, poverty would plummet to a record low 6%, the economy would grow by 5%, and the nation's $1.3 trillion deficit would turn into a surplus by Bernie Sanders' second term. So what questions do you have about Bernie Sanders' economic plan? What have you seen? What have you read? What questions do you have about what would happen if it were to be implemented? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Jerry, let's talk a little bit about how stimulus policies work. The New York Times had a piece, and the piece said that most economists believe that temporary increases in government spending will yield temporary increases in output. To see why the effect of stimulus is temporary, realize that if raising government spending raises output, then because the end of a stimulus program means cutting government spending, the same forces are later set in motion, but in reverse. And so in the standard story, a temporary stimulus improves the economy, but only temporarily. What are your thoughts on that, Jerry?
Well, I think those economists are operating within what John Maynard Keynes called a classical framework, where the economy is basically always at or moving towards full employment. You get some temporary deviations caused, for example, by a financial crisis, as happened 2007, 2008, but then the economy will move back on its own. So from that framework, what has happened is the Congressional Budget Office and other orthodox economists have actually been revising downward their expectation of what can be accomplished, how much economic growth we can have, how much employment we can have, in line with the economy's actual performance. So they have been reinterpreting the current economy to be at or close to full employment, regardless of the fact that we're producing about 13% less now than we would have been producing if we had continued on the trend that we were on before 2008. So we are always at or moving towards full employment. So anything the government does is going to be, you know, some blip, some temporary deviation, because you can't be above full employment for very long. So if we're at full employment and you spend a lot of through government stimulus, then of course you're not going to be able to sustain that. By definition, they have defined a way unemployment, and they have defined a way in the process, they have defined a way the possibility of effective stimulus, lasting Keynesian stimulus. I'm going back to Keynesian economics by arguing that the government can have a lasting effect by promoting new investment, new consumer spending, higher rates of employment, so that we will have a lasting effect. So the government spends, people have more income, they buy, they open new businesses, businesses invest, new people come back into the labor force. If we had the employment rates of Norway, we would have 18 million more people working right now.
Hmm.
That's a lot of people who are not able to be in the labor force, not able to have jobs and income, because our economy is underperforming. Government stimulus can have a lasting effect by putting those people to work and encouraging businesses to invest.
Mike, what would you add on the stimulus?
Well, I don't know if it's useful to try to figure out what the true Keynesian story, but, most people for the 20th century who would call themselves Keynesian would argue that, as you pull back on stimulus, the multiplier effect of that also goes down. There are ways in which government spending, especially in a time like now, could have long-term effects, but they wouldn't quite be the channel that Jerry's deciding. I mean, there's been a very conservative turn in economics, but that's very different than what I think we're discussing here. I think it's important to argue for the benefits of stimulus without overselling them or without arguing that they would necessarily be permanent in the way that is purely purely this kind of multiplier effect. I think government spending right now on infrastructure, on education, on many other things would increase our ability to innovate and would increase our real productivity and our real potential that we could have as an economy. But I do think that as the stimulus winds down under any kind of output gap or any kind of Keynesian story, you would have a pullback on demand as well. So I feel that that's a the critique leveled against the paper in that sense, I think it's correct, or at least I think it needs to be taken extremely seriously. However, even if that's even taking that seriously, there is room for us. There is room for things like infrastructure, especially when interest rates are so low, especially when the rest of the world wants to lend to us. There's so much room for infrastructure to really be a productive asset for our economy. So I feel like, you can make a positive case for kind of Bernie economics. And also Hillary economics, too, because I think she's also interested in infrastructure and things like universal pre-K, without necessarily having to overstate the case.
Well, I wanted to ask both of you about the open letter from past Council of Economic Advisors for Presidents Barack Obama and Bill Clinton to Senator Sanders and Professor Friedman. And it was signed by Alan Krueger of Princeton, Austin Goolsbee of the University of Chicago Booth School, Christina Romer of UC Berkeley, and Laura DeAndre Tyson of UC Berkeley. We invited all of them to join us, and they weren't available. And they write, "Making such promises runs against our party's best traditions of evidence-based policymaking and undermines our reputation as the party of responsible arithmetic. These claims undermine the credibility of the progressive economic agenda and make it that much more difficult to challenge the unrealistic claims made by Republican candidates." Jerry, what was your response when you saw this open letter?
Well, my first response was disappointment, because there's nothing in the letter that actually criticizes my method or what I did. The letter itself showed no signs that these people, three of whom I have sort of a personal relationship with, no sign that they had actually read my paper. Since then, I'm happy to say at least Christina Roma and I have had a very fruitful conversation, which, she published a more detailed critique with her husband. And I published a response to their critique. And I think we were able to move the dialogue forward in a more constructive way. That open letter was an attack on one of my final numbers, my rate of economic growth, but it did not include a critique of how I got there. And it's obviously illegitimate to criticize inclusion without criticizing the method. So that was how I felt about it, a certain amount of disappointment, which has been partly alleviated because we now have had a substantive discussion.
And
I disagree with them.
Mike, what would you add?
I think their criticism is on point, right? I mean, as Jerry said earlier, he rejects the methodology of the GAO and the CDO and government agencies and their definition and model of how the economy works and how stimulus and multipliers work. So if you're coming at it from a position which you reject those as methodological tools and empirical tools and theoretical tools, people like the Romers, people like former officials in government bureaucracy who use those techniques day in and day out will obviously not take kindly to that. So there's obviously one element of it. And a second is, a disagreement about how far could you push this, right? So a lot of people think we are 5% under capacity, that, a lot of people, I think, if you really push it, say 10 to 12% under capacity. I think the Romer said that, Jerry's analysis said we were close to like 30% under capacity, which, I think would, you need to make a lot more assumptions that really need to be stacked up correctly to push it that far. So, it's one of those things where, you can turn it up one notch and still everyone can kind of agree, but if you turn it up 5 or 10 notches, then it's a different story. And I think, as Jerry said, there's been a very productive back and forth between a lot of the principal agents here. And I think, it is all primaries are heated and contested, and, these are very big economic questions, so they bring out a lot of heat. But there's also been a little bit of light with it, too, which I think is very promising.
We have a question from Michael in Ithaca, New York, who says, have any other economists analyzed any other candidates' plans other than Sanders? And have any of the economists who've criticized Friedman's model run the Sanders plan through models of their own, which they think use more reasonable assumptions? Jerry?
There's been no or evaluation of any other candidate's plan because no other candidate has been so specific in putting out a full economic agenda. So it hasn't been possible. I mean, the Republicans, we have no idea what their spending plans would be, vague idea about their tax programs. And Hillary has a little more specifics, not quite enough that you can actually run a model, run it through something like what I did with Sanders. Some people have redone my model and come up with analogy similar numbers, which was very reassuring that I didn't make obvious, arithmetic mistakes. And then using different models, the Romer's model, the Romer's conclude that there'd be much lower rates of economic growth than I'm projecting, which is what you and you have stimulus having only a temporary effect. Even that, however, also depends on assumptions that you make about the other parts of the program, the impact of minimum wage increases and the net effect of tax increases. Nothing's been done quite comparable to what I did, which is kind of interesting, not surprising. It takes a lot of work. It would be refreshing if other candidates would put out more information so that we could try to do an evaluation of, Trump versus Clinton versus Cruz versus Sanders on apples-to-apples comparison. These are your tax programs, these are your regulatory programs, these are your spending programs, and here's the net effect on the economic growth, wages, et cetera. It's not yet possible to do that, and I'm just hoping that other candidates will put out more information.
Well, we'll talk a little bit about that right after the break. We will also talk about how Bernie Sanders is going to pay for these programs, because that question has been raised many, many times during the debates. Today we're joined by Gerald Friedman, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. He extensively analyzed Bernie Sanders' economic plan. Mike Konzel is a contributor to The Nation and a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. We'll also talk to Mike about why Bernie Sanders' Wall Street plan, in his mind, does not go far enough. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW, a program that relies on engaged listeners. We invite you to join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. Toll free, 866-798-8255. Or you can post your comment or question at yourcallradio.org, where you will also find links related to today's program. Coming up in 30 minutes at 11 o'clock from the BBC, it'll be World Have Your Say. Following that at noon today, it's Philosophy Talk, and then at 1 o'clock, Big Picture Science here on KALW San Francisco, a listener-supported community broadcast service of the San Francisco Unified School District.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about efforts to increase diversity in outdoor recreational activities. Only 20% of visitors to national parks are people of color, but some groups are working to close that gap. How do we encourage more people of color to reconnect with the great outdoors, and why is diversity necessary for the conservation movement? And then on Thursday, we will talk about money in Sacramento. We'll talk about whose interests are actually being represented in state government. We're talking about California government. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation about Bernie Sanders' economic plan, what questions do you have about it? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. Today we're joined by Gerald Friedman, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. He is author of the analysis, What Would Sanders Do? Estimating the Economic Impact of Sanders. Mike Konzel is a contributor to The Nation magazine and a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, where he focuses on inequality and a progressive vision of the economy. And we have an email from Rita who says, unless the Democrats achieve a veto-proof majority in Congress, nothing can be done. The radicals will still be trying to destroy the government, and government will still be gridlocked. Mike, what are your thoughts? I mean, this is the one question that Bernie Sanders is being asked about over and over again. There's no possible way you're going to implement these policies.
Well, you know, as a starting point, you know, it is not outside the realm of possibility that a strong Democratic candidate against someone like Donald Trump could have a huge down ballot effect. And though you probably wouldn't get 60 votes in the Senate, you could get 50, and you may even take the House, at which point, through budget reconciliation, there are ways to pass bills that, or you could weaken the rules of filibuster. I think it's important to have these debates because there is, you don't want to lose it, and, you know, someday the Democrats will have a majority, hopefully, and, you know, then these things become very relevant. However, I think one thing that goes missing, and unfortunately it's been unfortunate that Bernie Sanders has not pushed it far enough, is what exactly you could do to deal with the economy through the executive branch. There are so many powerful ways of influencing regulations, influencing domestic policy through appointments, through executive orders, through other decisions. You know, who the candidates put in charge of the Federal Reserve will probably matter a lot more than this or that minor budget point. The Federal Reserve has massive amounts of power over the way the economy works, the way the financial sector works, and appointments there would make a big difference. Enforcement of rules, both through the criminal justice code, the Department of Justice, through the regulatory process, through appointments and directions, have huge influence on the way financial sector will make loans and extend credits. And, you know, those differences, I think, matter a lot. They also obviously matter in terms of foreign policy, which is also a big difference between the candidates. That would have been something, and there's still plenty of time for Bernie Sanders to emphasize more about how his executive branch would just look different than a Clinton one, because Clinton obviously would look much different than a Trump or a Cruz one. And I think we can focus too much on Congress, and a lot of these debates about budgets and health care and spending and taxes are congressional issues, but the executive branch issues matter so much, I think we should never underplay them.
Well, this is important because even with, let's say Democrats did take over, I mean, how popular would his plan be with Democrats? Because Bill Curry, former White House counselor to President Clinton, has been really going after the Democrats in Salon. And he wrote in a recent piece, "I often talk to Democrats who do not know that Obama chose not to raise the minimum wage as president, even though he had the votes for it. He was willing to cut Medicare and Social Security and chose not to prosecute Wall Street crimes or pursue ethics reforms in government." So even if there was a Democratic majority in Washington, would Bernie Sanders' plans be popular among the Democrats that are currently in office or even running for office?
Well, let's talk about whether there's overlap between Hillary and Bernie Sanders. They both want at least a $12 minimum wage, which is much above our $7.25 minimum wage. Obama himself wanted a $10 minimum wage, so there's been big movement there. $12 minimum wage would make life a lot better for a ton of people, so we wouldn't want to downplay, even though it might not be the $15 one Bernie Sanders wants. They both want family leave policies, and they both want sick time policies, and they both want universal K, pre-K policies. You know, a big extension of the Family Leave and Medical Act that would guarantee paid time off for new parents would be a major expansion of social insurance. There's a big debate about how you pay for it between Bernie and Hillary, but they both agree that those are goals. They both agree that debt-free college, at the very least, is a priority. Bernie Sanders wants to make college actually free. Hillary Clinton famously does not want to pay for Donald Trump's kids. But either way, there is a goal on essentially federalizing the funding stream for public universities. How far that goes is a good question. So there are big differences, and we can talk. We're talking about them, and we'll talk about them more. But there's certainly overlap in the direction, if not the length, that we need to go with social insurance and workers' rights and a fair and just economy. So, I do think if Bernie was elected president, he may not get the dream package, but there's a lot of stuff he can work with people who have been fighting for these things so far.
What do you think, Jerry? Do you agree with that?
I would largely agree. Apart from single-payer health care, the differences between Bernie's proposals and Hillary's are quantitative. They both want a large infrastructure program. His is three times the size of hers, but realistically, if either of them was elected, we'd probably get something closer to what she's proposing. And that would be a really, really good thing. A $12 minimum wage would, as Mike said, raise incomes for maybe between 30 and 40 million Americans, as the poorest Americans. This would be a great improvement in society. And I don't know. I'm not a politician. I don't know what could actually be accomplished in Congress, or how much more could be done through the executive branch. But I think the major, as a student of social movements, the major point I'd like to make is that nothing will be accomplished unless there's a lot of pressure from people out in the streets and calling them members of Congress, protesting and demanding action. Franklin Roosevelt famously and perhaps apocryphally said to somebody in his office once, "Okay, you've persuaded me, now go out and make me do it." And if we have people in the streets, if we have people protesting and a mass public movement, then we'll get a moderate Democrat acting like a strong leftist Democrat, as happened with Roosevelt and as happened with Kennedy and Johnson. If we don't have people in the streets, if we don't have people mobilizing, then we'll get somebody with good progressive inclinations, like Barack Obama, acting like a moderate conservative Democrat, because that's where the pressure is. So what we need, and I think Bernie Sanders has contributed to this, is we need people to have a bigger vision of what is possible, what we can expect of government, what we can expect of an American society, and then going out and demanding it. Well, if we get that, then we'll be able to get a lot accomplished under either presidents, Clinton or Obama, or Sanders.
Well, over the weekend in Washington State, at two separate rallies, between 10 and 15,000 people turned out to see Senator Sanders. It got hardly any media coverage. And so a lot of people are taking to the streets, and yet you have many in the media and many liberal economists, including Paul Krugman, calling Bernie's plan voodoo economics.
Yeah, they're running scared. You know, the media is not giving that much attention to the tens of thousands of people attending Sanders rallies compared to the thousands attending Trump rallies or the hundreds attending rallies for other candidates. You know, there's much more talk about the horse race than about the issues. And liberal economists are, I think there's a feeling among some people who've been politically active for the last 8 years that they're nervous about trying for too much because it's been so difficult to get anything accomplished. But again, that was, we had Occupy. It wasn't sustained, but it did transform the debate. We've been talking about inequality much more since the Occupy movement. I think the lasting legacy of the Sanders campaign, assuming he doesn't get nominated, will be those thousands of people showing up in Seattle and Salt Lake City and all over the country. There's a constituency out there, a political constituency, of people ready to support much more far-reaching political agenda. And I think that's why Hillary Clinton has been talking about a $12 minimum wage. That's why she came out with an infrastructure program. She's talking about significant improvements in the Affordable Care Act. It's not single payer, but it's moving in the right direction. And I think that's going to last. And without it, we won't get anywhere with anybody elected president.
Gerald Friedman is professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst and author of the report about Bernie Sanders' economic plan, What Would Sanders Do? Estimating the Economic Impact of Sanders. Mike Konzel is contributor to The Nation and a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. You can join us at 866-798-8255. What are your thoughts about Bernie Sanders' economic plan, what we've been discussing here about how these issues can actually be implemented, what it will take also from citizens to encourage their politicians to embrace these plans? Feedback at yourcallradio is the email. And let's hear from Jerry in Oakland. Hi, Jerry. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for letting me call. My question centers around something that the economists may know as modern money theory, and about a Sanders economic advisor, Stephanie Kelton from the University of Missouri, and several others. And what it addresses is the sort of persistent fiction that we need federal taxes to be increased or levied in order to pay for these kinds of economic benefits that Sanders proposals would involve. And so my sense is that Sanders knows this and needs to be a bit more radical in proposing these ideas in order to capture the media. I wondered the thoughts of your economist.
Thank you. Mike, do you want to take that one?
I think Jerry might know MMT more than I do, so I'll give him the first question.
Okay. Jerry?
Well, the question, to some extent, has to do with the economic concept of seigneurage, where government prints money in lieu of taxes and profits from putting out, creating money. And I think there's certainly scope for that. Much of the increase in the public in the debt owed by the U.S. government over the last couple of years is actually owed to the Federal Reserve and to the Social Security Administration, because the Federal Reserve especially has been increasing the money supply and buying up government bonds. So the government owes that money to itself. And I think that there'd be room to have for the Sanders campaign to use more debt and less taxes. For whatever reason, they've proposed tax increases that over the 10 years will more or less balance the spending increases that they've proposed, which is why, as you mentioned at the top of the show, they'll be eliminating the public debt, the public deficit, the annual government deficit. I don't think that's a particularly good policy target, but they didn't ask me. You know, one other point about that four CEA, Council of Economic Advisers, letter to me and to Senator Sanders. There's been a fair amount of confusion, the New York Times and they themselves, about this. There's no connection between me and the Sanders campaign. I did go to them to ask to run by my numbers on what their program is, how much, you know, what elements are there and how much they're proposing to spend, how much they're proposing to tax. But they had no input into my report, and I gave them a copy of the report as a courtesy, but there's no connection. I'm not an advisor to the campaign, except on health care. I did give them advice on financing the single-payer plan based on work I had previously done for Physicians for National Health Plan. But I'm not associated with the campaign. It really was they should not have sent that letter to me and to Sanders. They should have just sent it to me. Sanders is responsible for his own stuff. I'm responsible for mine. We're different.
That's right, because you have said that you're supporting both Sanders and Clinton.
That's right. Within my household, we donate to both. We have a Sanders bumper sticker on the car, and I donate. My wife paid for that, and I donate every month to Hillary Clinton $10. We're big spenders over here.
And that is Gerald Friedman. He is professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. We're also joined by Mike Konzel, a contributor to The Nation and a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. And Mike, I wanted to get to the piece you wrote for The Nation. Bernie's Wall Street plan is actually not enough. You write about three ways he can make his plan a, quote, real threat to the finance industry. So what's number one?
Sure. So I think there's So Bernie's very concentrated on the largest players and breaking them up in terms of size and scale, right? So he wants Glass-Steagall to slice them on business lines. He wants to break them up and slice them into much smaller pieces. But, you know, investment banks by themselves, which you would have after Glass-Steagall, are still very dangerous. Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, Goldman Sachs, these are things that were big problems in the crisis. Even breaking up the banks, you'd still have firms that were maybe $500 billion in size. That's pretty big. That's the size of Bear Stearns. That's the size sort of very close to Lehman. So you still have some problems. And so what I said, what I wrote in that piece is that I hope the Sanders campaign considers keeping that agenda and adding a few more things that I think really get to the problems of finance. And one is just much higher capital requirements. Basically just saying, banks have to fund themselves less with risky debt and fund themselves more with equity. It's almost like putting a speed limit on the financial sector. And by, you know, forcing them, kind of puts a little bit of cushion, and that helps both with the riskiness of finance and also gives it makes it a lot easier to deal when something goes wrong because there's that extra cushion in the financial sector. Crucially, that's something that Dodd-Frank has done a fair amount, but if you could kick it up a little bit,